This week on the Best of Flashpoints, a right-wing hate blogger framed the Cordoba House Project as the Ground Zero Mosque, and the mainstream media ran with it. Ali Abu Nima calls it political Kristallnacht. And Transocean, the owner of BP's failed oil rig in the Gulf, has been doing business with notorious Burmese drug traffickers. Plans to build an Islamic community center, 2.5 blocks from where the Twin Towers once stood in Lower Manhattan, has become the political issue dominating the daily news cycle in the United States. Branded the Ground Zero Mosque by its right-wing critics, the Cordoba House Project is described by its leaders as a cultural center patterned along the lines of a YMCA that will include a place for Muslims to pray. Salon.com has reported that the once innocuous story of Cordoba House, first covered in the New York Times in December of last year with barely a blip on the radar, was radicalized by right-wing blogger Pamela Geller on her viciously anti-Muslim website, Atlas Shrugs. Geller's writing on the issue included blog posts titled, "Monster Mosque Pushes Ahead in Shadow of World Trade Center Islamic Death and Destruction." Geller was soon picked up by Rupert Murdoch's New York Post, starting in May of this year. Salon reports that Geller's hate group, Stop Islamization of America, and their anti-Cordoba House organizing was publicized and mainstreamed by the New York Post, and then amplified and elaborated on by none other than right-wing cable giant Fox News, framing the story as the inherently wrong and suspect Ground Zero Mosque. Geller has falsely reported on her blog that Cordoba House plans to open on September 11th, 2011, and that it is planned for Ground Zero as a form of, quote, Islamic domination and expansionism. The location is no accident, Geller has blogged, just as Al-Aqsa was built on top of the temple in Jerusalem, unquote. The results have been that Republicans are using the Cordoba House story as a campaign wedge issue for the November midterm elections, and most Democrats are either running away from the issue or sliding towards it. Today, Howard Dean, once the liberal standard bearer for the Democratic left, said that the Cordoba House project should be moved to appease its critics.
I believe that the people who are trying to build a mosque are trying to do something that's good, but there's no point in starting off trying to do something that's good if it's going to meet with an enormous resistance from a lot of folks. This is a very delicate, difficult religious and cultural issue. I think it's great to have mosques in American cities. There's a growing number of American Muslims. I think most of those Muslims are moderate. I hope that they'll have an influence on Islam throughout the world, because Islam is really back in the 12th century in some of these countries like Iran and Afghanistan, where they're stoning people to death, and that can be fixed.
Former Bush White House strategist Karl Rove agrees with Howard Dean. Rove framed the political issues for the benefit of GOP campaign strategists on Fox News yesterday.
There is a freedom of religion that is ingrained in our Constitution, and that right of freedom of free expression of religion would be best exercised by not building it here. Look, we've got a free, in that same First Amendment, there's a right of freedom of speech. Who believes that, say, skinheads should show up at a black sorority convention and scream bigoted remarks? Who believes there's a right of freedom of assembly? Who believes that, you know, neo-Nazis should show up at the B'nai B'rith Hotel and have their meeting in the same, you know, in the next meeting room? There are rights that everyone has that we believe it would be prudent not to exercise them at certain times. And this right that they have to build a religious building where they want should be prudently exercised elsewhere. It should not be done here.
I'm Eric Klein for Flashpoints Up Front.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Thank you, Eric. We continue with the Ground Zero Mosque. Joining us from Chicago is Ali Abu Nima, the founder of the Electronic Intifada.net. Welcome back to Flashpoints, Ali. Been anxious to get you in the dialogue on this. You heard Karl Rove add to that Harry Reid. Obama's backpedaling. Harry Reid said yesterday the First Amendment protects freedom of religion, he said, but he thinks the mosque should go somewhere else. Your initial response, Karl Rove's false parallel, what do you think of that?
Well, the stunning thing was there was a headline on ABC today that Karl Rove was worried about some of the heated rhetoric coming from the Republican Party. So it's coming to something when Karl Rove is a voice of moderation among Republicans. But, you know, the bigotry and the blatant incitement against Muslims that is coming from the Republicans really is not the shocking thing or the surprising thing. That's been going on for years. In the run-up to the 2008 election, and it's never gone away. What I think is really terrifying is the cowardice and complicity and joining in of mainstream Democrats. Dennis, this week has brought back a lot of bad memories for me, and I think a lot of other people in this country, of the immediate aftermath of 9/11. And in those days and weeks, and I was in New York two or three days after the attacks, I drove there because my sister and her family live literally blocks from the site of the World Trade Center, and they were displaced from their home. And it was a terrifying time for everybody who went through that. And we were afraid in Arab communities and Muslim communities of a backlash. People were really braced for violence, for scapegoating. And what was remarkable is that a lot of public officials came out against scapegoating, against blaming Arabs and Muslims in this country, and collective guilt, collective punishment of Arabs and Muslims. And that included President Bush. It included Democrats. I remember I was invited, along with a lot of other community members and activists and organizations, to a press conference with Senator Dick Durbin a few days after 9/11 to make that point. And although there were some incidents, the worst was avoided. What is terrifying now is that none of those public officials are coming out. They are all joining in. And what we see is really unprecedented levels of incitement and vilification. And I called it on something I wrote on Twitter, a political Kristallnacht. And I chose those words carefully because, on the real Kristallnacht in 1938, hundreds of synagogues were destroyed and many people were killed. And we think
you're referring to Nazi Germany.
Nazi Germany, yes. But what is similar here, and you know that incident was, the Kristallnacht was precipitated by the assassination of a German ambassador in Paris by a young Jewish man. And the revenge against all the Jews of Germany was Kristallnacht. And it was, of course, preceded by demonization, by vilification, by collective guilt and collective accusation. And, of course, all of these insane conspiracy theories that we're hearing now, that Muslims are trying to take over the United States, that, Muslims have a plan to impose Islamic law on the United States, real vilification, which is not just staying on the fringes anymore. It's coming into the mainstream. And really, the signal, I think what opened the floodgates was Obama's cave-in. He made that speech last Friday night defending the right of the people to build this community center on property they owned in Lower Manhattan in an area where there are other mosques already, where there are strip joints and betting shops and falafel stands. And I mean, the whole notion that this is hallowed ground and that somehow this community center would desecrate it is really saying that all Muslims, and first of all, that all Muslims are somehow guilty and implicated in 9/11, and secondly, that Muslims cannot be Americans. And, in May, there was a bombing of a mosque in Florida. This, of course, wasn't widely reported in the media, but people can go and Google it. A mosque in Jacksonville was bombed. And where I'm afraid this is leading is to such an atmosphere of incitement and vilification and hate that it won't be long before we see more violence directed against Muslims or people who are confused for Muslims, unless we see leaders stepping up and saying enough. And I don't see that right now.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we're speaking with Ali Abunima. And also, speaking of 9/11, Ali, when we look at who's in the middle of this in New York City, Faisal Abdul Rauf, he's no stranger to the FBI. In fact, I believe he was in the Bush White House right after 9/11. He was invited by the FBI to address agents. So we here are talking to somebody who is welcomed in by the law enforcement community as a voice of reason, has now become a dangerous Islamic radical. That's pretty interesting, isn't it?
Well, and more than that, he was actually sent by the State Department to Saudi Arabia and on other missions to represent American Muslims and to represent the United States and to talk, ironically, about, you know, the freedoms and the good life that Muslims enjoy in the United States. You know, look, since 9/11, Muslims have been lectured constantly that you must be moderate, you must fight extremism, you must condemn this and condemn that. And few other Muslim leaders who have not done that, although they're always accused of not condemning terrorism. In fact, every Muslim organization of any you know, repute or any size in this country has done that repeatedly and constantly because it's constantly demanded of them. And what this shows is that someone like the Imam Rauf, who's behind this project, who is, you know, if the State Department could design a Muslim, it would be someone like Rauf, who you know, as we've discussed. But what this new rhetoric and incitement is saying is there is no such thing as a good Muslim. And that's what takes us back. And I don't want to be hyperbolic about it, but, you know, there was no such thing as a good Jew in Nazi Germany. It didn't matter. You know, there weren't extremist Jews and moderate Jews. They hated all Jews. And we are hearing a rhetoric in this country where all Muslims are inherently bad. We are hearing, you know, the equivalent of the blood libels that leveled against Jews are now being leveled against Muslims, that they have a secret conspiracy to, you know, take over the United States, that they do all these horrible things. This is a frightening parallel. And what is even more worrying to me is there doesn't seem to be any breaks to it. You know, the people who you would normally look to, who are marketed to us as the progressive and the left wing or you know, pro-human rights or whatever it is, are jumping on the bandwagon. We heard in the introduction Howard Dean, who was the liberal left-wing standard bearer in 2000 or 2004, whenever that was. We've seen Harry Reid, the Senate Democratic leader. We saw Aaron David Miller, the you know, supposed peacenik, you know, former State Department official. And I think the other thing that is so interesting here, Dennis, and so important for people to keep an eye on, is that I'm not saying all of it, but a lot of this incitement, or let's say there has been a convergence between the extremist right Christian right wing in this country, the radical Christianists, if you want, who are very powerful, and the extreme right wing anti-Palestinian pro-Israeli groups, and you know, people like Abe Foxman have gotten together with Pastor John Hagee, and they are mainstreaming this Islamophobia. The Christianist radicals, for their own theological reasons, because they think it'll hasten the Armageddon, which they're very eager for, and the pro-Israeli groups, because they fear, you know, that support for Israel is slipping and they're upping the ante. They're saying, you know, we are on the same side as you of civilization against these Muslim savages. And so we see this convergence between a lot of the anti-Palestinian pro-Israel groups and the Christian right. And the other thing that I think is so important is that this, and this is being well reported, is this is a deliberate electoral strategy by the Republicans. And it doesn't just target Muslims. Muslims are now the ones in the headline. But it's a deliberate strategy targeting three groups: Muslims, LGBTQ people, and immigrants. Those are the scapegoats now in this country, and we had better all stick together. We also have to have zero tolerance for people who make excuses for the bigotry, because I've heard time and again, well, you know, the Democrats have to pick their battles. Well, I am sorry. Nobody would dare say that if Jews were the targets of a national campaign of incitement and hatred like this. And, you know, I think back in the day when mainstream national figures like Henry Ford and Joe Kennedy, the father of President John F. Kennedy, you know, spouted anti-Semitic rhetoric, people just shrugged. And that was probably very similar to how it is today. The anti-Semitism of Henry Ford and Joe Kennedy and many others in the American establishment was probably as acceptable in their day as this anti-Islamic hysteria is in 2010. And we have to really learn the lessons and say enough, and we're not going to allow this to happen again.
And finally, I can't let you go, Ollie, without just a word, a minute on your response to the way the press is eating this up and going for the jugular.
Well, you know, I mean, let's not even talk about the cable channels that are just a real hate festival, festival of incitement and defamation. But look at the so-called, you know, high-quality press. The New York Times has been running op-ed day after day about this, and they still haven't gotten around to, you know, having a Muslim, someone who's affected by this, by the incitement, given opinion about it. And it's been the same across the board in the Washington Post. You know, they haven't had anyone, and I haven't seen anything really. Very, very few things. You know, so again, Muslims are excluded. They're the targets of this hatred and incitement, and they're not even allowed to speak for themselves. And that should tell us a lot, that we are not being allowed to hear from the very communities and people that are being described as a threat to the very foundations of the United States, just the way, you know, 500,000 Jews. There were 500,000 Jews in Germany, a tiny percentage of the population. As Muslims, they're a tiny percentage of the population in this country, and they're, like Jews, being accused of wanting to bring down the country and being involved in a global conspiracy to bring down the United States. Wake up, people. We have seen this before. Don't make excuses for it. Stand up and fight it.
Ali Abanima of the Electronic Intifada.net. Thank you for being with us, Ali.
Thank you.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, we're going to take a look at what appears to be some pretty interesting disinformation or a real coincidence. If you were watching Meet the Press on Sunday, you saw General Petraeus, the new head of the U.S. war in Afghanistan, talking about the dangers of leaving Afghanistan too soon. This is a month in which we have seen the most U.S. casualties since the beginning of the war. And Petraeus, to bolster his perspective, quotes from the cover story, a Time magazine cover story, that features a young Afghan woman with her nose cut off. And Petraeus says, this is the kinds of things that we'll be facing and that women in particular will be facing if we leave Afghanistan too quickly. In other words, the general is there and the United States government is there to protect women from having their noses cut off. There are problems with this story. Somebody who's been looking at it very closely is Lucinda Marshall. Marshall is director of the Feminist Peace Network, which just posted the piece, Time Story About Afghan Women, Questions Raised About Authors' Vested Interests and Accuracy of the Story. Lucinda Marshall, welcome to Flashpoints.
Dennis, thank you for having me on tonight.
Well, it is so good to have you with us. And first of all, give us a little bit of a thumbnail sketch. What does the story say? And then what's wrong with the picture and the story?
Well, to give you some background, when Time ran this piece, and it was in the August 9th issue, the managing editor, Rick Stengel, wrote a introduction to it that talked about how Time did not want to write a piece that supported or opposed the war, but and this was right after the initial release of WikiLeaks documents, what they wanted to do, and I'm quoting him, was to illuminate what's actually happening on the ground. And so they've got the story of this woman who was brutally attacked, and then again, quoting, he says, for Afghan women, an early withdrawal of international forces could be disastrous. But as they also point out, what happened to this young woman happened last year. And we have been in Afghanistan, you know, for a number of years now, and women are still having this happen. So you start to look at the background here, and, you know, the question is, okay, we've been there. In what way have things improved for Afghan women? And the answer is not so much. Afghanistan has the second highest maternal mortality rate in the world. It's the only country that has a suicide rate for women that is higher than for men. Girls' schools continue to be bombed. Women are being excluded from peace talks. Where I'm sitting from, the issue of abandoning women is really a false issue. We never went there for their protection in the first place, and 9 years later, we haven't done much. And Peter Hart over at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting points out they could have just as easily run a story that says, what happens if we stay in Afghanistan? But, you know, it's easy enough that you could just dismiss this as, okay, an editorial decision that we don't like, but it's more than that. Because in those WikiLeaks documents that Stengel refers to, there is a CIA document that specifically calls for using the stories of Afghan women to basically pitch the war, to sell it, to promote it. And let me just quote from that memo. Media opportunities for Afghan women to share their stories with French, German, and other European women could help overcome pervasive skepticism among women in Western Europe towards the mission. Media events that feature testimonials by Afghan women would probably be most effective if broadcast on programs that have large and disproportionately female audiences. So what we know is there is one memo. I'm guessing there's more, as you recall, when we went into the war, you know, in late 2001, we were being told about the women and how they were being victimized by the Taliban. Well, this has been going on for quite some time, and we really didn't care until we needed to come up with a really solid reason for going in there. So all of a sudden, they became kind of a selling point for the war. My guess is, you know, if there's one CIA document, we know it's used as a selling point at the beginning, there's probably a good deal more paper on this issue that's going to lead to a really solid paper trail of saying, yes, we are using these women to sell the war. So this isn't an arbitrary piece of journalism, this piece that Time ran. The New York Times ran a piece the same week, as did McClatchy, talking about the plight of Afghan women. But here's where it gets interesting, okay? On, I believe it was Friday, the New York Observer ran a piece questioning whether, in fact, the Taliban was indeed responsible for this, and then Ann Jones had a piece in The Nation as well, questioning whether, in fact, the story is accurate in the first place, and also questions about the reporter who wrote the story, because her husband is a Afghan-American entrepreneur, apparently, who is a board member of the Afghan Government Ministers Project advocating foreign investment in Afghanistan. So, you know, I'm not saying that she didn't write an unbiased piece, but certainly that's the kind of thing that ought to be disclosed, those kinds of connections.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and now Up Front with Jesse Strauss.
On Monday, I reported that an Israeli soldier posted photos of herself with bound Palestinian prisoners on her own Facebook page. Eden Abergil, the soldier, has spoken both to the media and written in her public Facebook page in a gross defense of her actions. She has allegedly written on her Facebook page that, quote, in war there are no rules, unquote. She also wrote that she would, quote, gladly kill Arabs, even slaughter them, unquote. Finally, she wrote, quote, "I can't allow Arab lovers to ruin the perfect life I lead," unquote. As the Israeli military has no jurisdiction over whether she can publish these photos, it has quieted itself while Abigail continues to speak up in her own righteousness. The state of Israel has been outed for paying $36 million to U.S. media sources in order to skew coverage of the country's actions. The files published now on the website of the Institute for Research on Middle Eastern Policy are the result of an investigation by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the Department of Justice, which was focused on $36 million which entered the U.S. for the purpose of promoting Israeli foreign policy through our media. The investigation was sealed until July 23rd. Included in the subpoena documents which were examined by the Senate investigation are numerous statements with the outright intent to enforce the, quote, "stimulation and placement of suitable articles in major consumer magazines," unquote. Grant F. Smith, the director of the Institute for Research on Middle Eastern Policy, speaking on Russia Today Television News, explained the documents in further detail and its wider relevance.
They revealed, for example, a vast effort to divert U.S. attention from the Israeli Dimona nuclear weapons facility by saying it was merely a research center. They carefully tracked how that story was playing in the U.S. media. And they also were using outlets such as The Atlantic magazine, funneling $50,000 into that magazine in a major effort to disrupt a U.S. peace proposal, which would have involved bringing some Palestinian refugees and allowing them to return to their homes and properties in Israel.
The influence of the $36 million is huge, especially for those families that were not allowed to return to their land. But this is clearly a pattern, not a singular event.
We've done a lot of work over the years obtaining documents about Israeli policy initiatives in the United States. And the documentary record suggests a heavy influence on the part of Israeli politicians and various parastatal groups that work tightly with Israel without disclosing those relationships. They have successfully built a campaign financing system in the United States that's extremely effective at pushing Israeli objectives by withholding or dispersing campaign funding to U.S. politicians. So there is a high degree of control that's in place, but for your average American, it's almost completely hidden.
Smith explained that these reports speak to how strongly the media responds to financial influence.
Major U.S. publications that were on the receiving end of the $36 million really fell into line for a whole host of initiatives. Now, the Senate investigation was a failure, and they essentially heavily censored the Senate transcript and then put all of these extremely damning files into sealed records for years and years so that nobody could really see what was going on.
Along with the apparent congressional cover-up, Smith explained that this experience shows us a lot about the role of the media in the U.S. and the simplicity of getting around U.S. rules on influencing coverage.
The groups that were involved in this, they were ultimately forced to register as foreign agents and disclose their activities. They simply transferred all of these activities into a group called the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee.
Finally, Smith emphasized this long-term project to influence our media coverage, explaining that it has been a downward spiral against truth.
For the United States, it's extremely important for people to see this media influence and the mechanics of it, because over the passage of time, this has only gotten worse.
The cover story in The Atlantic magazine, which was at the center of the aforementioned scandal involving millions of dollars from Israel to influence U.S. media coverage, is currently a story claiming that Israel is ready to bomb Iran unless the U.S. dramatically changes its foreign policy stance in the Middle East. On August 8th, New York police were called to the scene of a fight. Only a few minutes after they arrived, officers fired their guns 46 times. The firing was initiated after one of the men who was fighting allegedly shot a gun in their direction. The other man who had been fighting was shot 23 times. One might think that Angel Alvarez is lucky to be alive, but he is now caught up in a deeper drama. After living through 23 bullets entering his body, having been shot by New York cops, Alvarez is being charged with three weapons charges. Even more concerning is the fact that the only witnesses to the initial shot being fired by the other man who was fighting are the police officers who themselves unleashed 43 bullets. In Berkeley, I'm Jesse Strauss, with thoughts of the victims of apartheid and media cover-up, and victims of police brutality and outrageous excessive use of force. You've been listening to Flashpoints Up Front.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Thanks, Jesse. My name is Dennis Bernstein. According to new revelations coming out of the Mazima News Agency in Chiang Mai, Thailand, U.S.-Swiss drilling company Transocean has admitted it is under investigation by the U.S. Treasury Department over its operations in Myanmar, that's Burma, and its ongoing business partnership with a major Burmese-based money launderer named Stephen Law. The probe comes amid intense public scrutiny of Transocean since its rig blew up in the Gulf of Mexico. In fact, Transocean recently received an administrative subpoena from the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control regarding its operations in Myanmar, also known as Burma. The subpoena from the U.S. Government Sanctions Enforcement Division came after Mazima first reported in May that Transocean's U.S. regulatory filings showed the firm was hired late last year to do drilling work in Burmese waters co-owned by a company controlled by Stephen Law. Law's father is the legendary former Golden Triangle heroin distributor Lo Sing Han. Law and his father are alleged by the U.S. government to be major drug money launderers. They are not allowed to travel in the United States or in Europe. Flashpoint spoke to Thomas Meng Shui, the author of this explosive story in Chiang Mai, Thailand, just before airtime. Why don't you talk a little bit first about the background here and remind people what we know about Stephen Law?
Well, he's the son of a man who was Lau Sit Hong, who was believed in the 1970s to control Southeast Asia's best armed narcotics militia. And the senior Lau Sit Hong ended up coming to peace with the Burmese regime, the military junta, sometime in the early 1980s. And he basically agreed to go semi-legitimate, move to Rangoon, and just basically cut the regime in on the profits of what they were doing up in northern Burma. And that's really how you make peace with the regime. You cut the generals in on the business you're doing. You give them profits of your heroin trade, and they're happy.
And to point out that the part of the deal included them being able to control these traffickers, to control the ports, interesting, and some major bus routes.
Yeah, that's right. And if, really, they basically, they played their cards right, Stephen Law and his father. And when they set up shop in Rangoon, it was just before the Burmese economy really started opening, and they were able to just get in there at the right time and buy up the highways, and they have toll roads, hotels, and they use their money wisely, you could say, and they've really made key investments using their connections with the generals. They were initially very well connected with Kin Young, who was the head of military intelligence, and he was pushed out in a purge about 5 years ago, and they had enough friends in the other side that they survived. A lot of other businessmen didn't do so well after Kin Young was purged, but Stephen Law and his father ended up doing fine, and then they've continued to grow as their little empire in Burma has grown, as the generals have made more money as well. And unfortunately, that really it hasn't done anything for the people of Burma, and Burma today is still very, very, what we're seeing here is the emergence of a natural resource curse, where you have people like these narco drug lords who are getting involved in the oil industry, the gas industry, and the generals are making money, and they're making money with the multinational oil firms, and the people of Burma are really suffering. And that's kind of where Transocean comes in.
Well, and Stephen Law, of course, and his family are very good at concealing their integration into various aspects of the major businesses of our time, oil, banking. When we discovered them. They were using Singapore, the so-called anti-drug capital of the world, and major U.S. banks to cover their operations. So tell us a little bit about how Stephen Law, this drug trafficker, who I think is still not allowed to travel to the United States, is engaged with Transocean.
Well, the Law family, they own stakes in Burmese offshore gas area. They have a partnership with a consortium that includes the Chinese National Overseas Oil Corporation, CNOOC, and a company that's controlled by the Stephen Law and his wife, Cynthia Noe, who's a Singapore citizen. And that company used to be called Golden Aaron. And as soon as it was on the EU and the U.S. sanctions list, so Stephen Law decided to changed the name to China Focused Development. I mean, it's a listed company in Singapore. They own about three offshore, they own stakes in three offshore gas areas off the coast of Burma. And Transocean, we found out in earlier this year, and we broke the story in May, that Transocean had done drilling work for CNOOC, in which all of CNOOC's blocks owned off the coast of Burma are owned in partnership with the Law family. So anytime you're drilling for CNOOC off the coast of Burma, you're also drilling for the Law clan. And we pointed that out, and it didn't make as much news as we thought it would. But eventually, the U.S. government seems to have woken up and has subpoenaed Transocean to find out more information and about what happened and this drilling work that happened for 3 months. According to Transocean documents, they were doing this from September 2009 to December 2009. And then, of course, the world woke up and found out about Transocean in April. That's when I had heard a little bit about Transocean before, but really we started looking into more about what they were doing in Burma after the horrible deaths of the employees in the Gulf of Mexico. And I think a lot of people around the world have sort of woken up to see what, you know, looked into Transocean, which is the biggest offshore oil drilling company in the world, but also it's not really a household, it wasn't a household name up until, you know, just recently.
Now, they've done some shifting around, moved their headquarters to Switzerland, and they are in business with the Chinese, and it's been claimed that Transocean didn't need to mention the fact that they were in business with this major trafficker of the Golden Triangle because, well, explain that.
Well, they told the Times, the New York Times did a story in July, and they sent the Times a statement, which the Times quoted from quite a bit in their article. This is it actually made the front page of the New York Times. They were talking about focusing on Transocean, not just in Burma, but their activities in other blacklisted company countries. But what they told the Times was that because the name Stephen Law and Lau Sit Han were not on the contract, then they weren't in violation of the U.S. sanctions. But what we found to be quite ridiculous, or, you know, it's inconceivable, but they didn't know that when they were drilling in those areas that it was co-owned with the Law clan. And also, it seems from people we've talked to in the industry that it would have been written out in the contract, you know, the different partners. So maybe the Law family, you know, their names weren't there, but it's almost certain that, you know, Golden Aaron or their other name, China Focused Development, was listed. And if Stephen Law and his father weren't there, their names weren't on the contract. As Transocean says, it's quite certain that his wife, Cynthia Noe, was on the contract. Transocean didn't deny, they didn't mention in the Times, what they told the Times, anything about Cynthia Noe, but she's also on the U.S. sanctions blacklist and blacklisted from going to Europe and blacklisted from going to actually most of the Western world because
now
of
these
her.
Are all drug sanctions, right?
Which yeah.
They're blacklisted because of their history, expansive history in the drug trade, which really included perhaps the largest drug operation in Southeast Asia for several decades, the heroin going into the veins of U.S. kids throughout the 60s and the 70s, compliments of this part of the world and these people.
Yeah, they got on the sanctions list. They were targeted. The Bush administration put them on the sanctions list first about 6 years ago, and they're quite notorious because of how they started. They made all their money in the drug business. And then at the same time, after they were listed, a bunch of other tycoons who were close to the junta also got listed. The Law Clan were the first big cronies of the Burmese regime to be put on because of their notoriety and their connections with drugs and heroin. And after Lau Sithon moved to Rangoon and started cutting, they sort of shifted from production to more money laundering and running these ports and stuff like that. Khun Sa sort of took his place and up in the north of Burma, and then Khun Sa became, you know, America's bad man, and he eventually did the exact same thing that Lau Sithon did and moved to Rangoon and cut the generals in. It's quite interesting. And of course, both Lau Sithon and Khun Sa got started in the KMT, which, you know, the remnants of Chiang Kai-shek's forces in China that fled into Burma after the fall of Chiang Kai-shek in China. So it's, you know, it's very, if you read The Politics of Heroin by Alfred McCoy, it's, see the history really of heroin in Southeast Asia. It's quite a nasty, long history. And There still is heroin coming from this area, but mostly now it's in amphetamines and Hamid Karzai or his brother and friends in Afghanistan have really somebody's growing heroin there, and that's really sort of undercut a lot of the heroin production in this part of the world.
And it's so interesting because China is fiercely anti-drug. Singapore is fiercely anti-drug. United States is supposed to be, the banks are supposed to be controlled and have various sanctions in terms of drug money laundering. And yet it's these anti-drug countries and operations that help to front and to legitimize Stephen Law, maybe not in drugs now, but he's rather influential still in the country, right? And
yeah,
it's his relationship and his work that helps to float one of the most vicious dictatorships in the world.
Absolutely. And certainly when they first brought a lot of money 20 years ago to Singapore, it was definitely drug money. I mean, and they still are involved in laundering narcotics money if they've sort of shifted away from, you know, the actual production. But Singapore, really, they were quite happy. They welcomed the Lau Sithon and Stephen Law with open arms. And it's they're not the only ones from Burma who have been connected in, you know, the something that Singapore claims to be, you know, strongly against. They execute lots of poor Filipinos, Burmese, Indonesians, migrant workers who, you know, have been tricked into bringing it in, or for whatever reason, Singapore, you know, routinely executes a lot of people for drug trafficking, yet they allow their banks to be used for money laundering and all kinds of nefarious stuff. And it is quite ironic, I think. In fact, I recall your article mentioned how the Singapore government's overseas investment fund invested in a hotel project in Rangoon, the Shangri-La Trade Winds Hotel with or Traders Hotel with Stephen Law and his father. So it was just, when that was pointed out by opposition politicians in Singapore, you know, the Singapore government denied it, and then they sort of ignored the story and tried to make it go away. And it's interesting that the OFAC is now, because of our article, has subpoenaed Transocean, is forcing them to come clean about what they knew. And I suspect that Transocean knew from the beginning who they were getting involved with, and it's not a, you know, it's not a big surprise. You know, all they needed to do was do a quick Google search to find out how infamous the Law Clan is, and yeah, they really can't claim ignorance on this one. But you know, this is the same company that said all their equipment was working fine in the Gulf of Mexico, and obviously that's not true. So there's a lot more to for us to find out, and it's I think it's good what the U.S. government has finally got around to doing this, but it does remain to be seen what does end up happening. I mean, a lot of these oil companies, you know, they'll pay a small fine or whatever, or, you know, as Barclays just paid some fine for breaking sanctions. They settled today, actually, or yesterday, for breaking sanctions that included with Burma. It was Burma, Iran, and Sudan. But if you compare, you know, the amount of punishment an individual from, you know, these, you know, people have been caught up in the war on terror and whatever, and compared to what the punishment for corporations, I think it's quite, you know, a bit of a contradiction that these companies get away with, you know, blatant violations or what appear to be blatant violations. And if it hadn't been for our article, I do believe that Transocean would have been continuing working with the Law Clan. I don't know if they will continue now, but we'll see.
I remember I did a piece for the Boston Globe that pointed out how Northwest Airlines was giving a special package to visit Burma and stay at Stephen Law's hotel. And after we published it in the Boston Globe, they dropped the package, but they're willing to go ahead as long as nobody's watching. Let me tell people, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is a breaking news exclusive coming out of Chiang Mai in the north of Thailand. The journalist is Thomas Mung Shui. He works with the Mazima News Agency in Chiang Mai. And we're talking about Transocean. Remember Transocean? They're in bed, in business with BP. They destroyed large parts of the Gulf of Mexico, trying to figure that one out still. And apparently that hasn't stopped them from continuing to do business. And they're doing business at an accelerated rate. This is one of many operations, but this one happens to be with helping to empower some of the worst dictators in the world in Burma. And they happen to be doing it with significant people with significant histories of drug trafficking. So significant are they that the entire family, Stephen Law, his wife in the middle of this, father, none of them have been allowed to come to the United States for some time. I guess we wonder now where this story goes. Have you tried to talk to U.S. officials? What's on your mind? What do you think is going to happen here, and where do we go?
Well, we tried to call OFAC a couple times, the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, and we couldn't actually get through to anybody. We didn't actually get an interview, but it will be interesting to see what happens. The other thing that the Transoceans, this isn't the only people they were working for off the coast of Burma. They also were doing drilling work for another infamous project, which is it was closer actually to the Bangladesh-Burma border area, and they were drilling off the coast of Arakan State for Daewoo. And in the fall of 2008, Burmese Navy escorted a Transocean drilling ship into contested waters, and they caused a naval standoff between Bangladesh and Burma, and the two countries almost came to blows. It was the most tense time in 4 years between Bangladesh and Burma, and Transocean's drilling rig was in the middle of it, and actually three Bangladeshi people farmers who live on the border were actually shot and killed by Burmese soldiers that week because of the tensions were so high. It really raises serious questions as to what Transocean was thinking. They sent the ship there. The waters are both contested by Bangladesh and Burma, and the Bangladeshi government had 2 weeks before this happened in the fall of 2008, they had been assured by the Burmese regime that there would be no drilling in this area until they had come to some mutual agreement about who controlled the rights of this offshore area. And then 2 weeks later, Transocean's ship drilling rig is escorted in there by the Burmese Navy while they're working for Daewoo. And it was these are very expensive pieces of equipment, and you really wonder what they were doing bringing it into this what ended up being a massive naval standoff that lasted for about a week. The Bangladeshi sort of surrounded the Transocean vessel, and this standoff happened for about a week. It was stranded there. It really makes you wonder why they were doing this. Their insurance was covered, because most insurance projects aren't covered in Burma because of the sanctions, but at that time their insurance was covered by the Korean government's political risk insurance program for overseas Korean operations. And we're trying to find out who covered the insurance for Transocean while they're working for the Law Clan and CNOOC. So these are some other questions we're interested in and trying to dig this up. And obviously the companies are not very forthcoming. The fact that Transocean was subpoenaed, that came out. Two lines mentioned it in their latest filings with the SEC. And, you know, this is a, you know, 30, 40 page filing. And if you don't know what you're looking for, you never see it. It's buried right in the middle of some text about some totally different stuff. And it's very, you know, these international corporations that increasingly control so much of our lives, they're really, you know, who's really watching them? If you listen to the rhetoric of the U.S. government, the Western governments, they say we have these strong sanctions against Burma, blah, 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 but it's quite clear that they really aren't paying attention most of the time. And this is really something that it is a concern, I think. What's the point in making these statements and saying we support democracy in such and such a place if you are allowing companies like Transocean, which is essentially an American corporation that's nominally based in landlocked Switzerland, you know, to go and do business with people who are on your so-called black, you know, evil drug dealers list that the DEA and the OFAC put out every year and say these are bad people, blah, 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 yet Transocean is doing business with them. It is quite ironic, I think.
And, of course, another very important sidebar to this story is the fact that these narco-terrorists in Burma, this brutal, vicious dictatorship. After the great storm there, they let people die. They brutalized people. They stole aid. This same government that's being empowered now by Transocean, and you have to say by the Western powers when they don't take action, is furiously trying to get a hold of nuclear weapons.
Yeah, well, that's something that's quite interesting, and I think they are these accounts actually in Singapore. There's mostly money that's so far coming from Chevron and Total's offshore gas projects, which are online and have been online for nearly a decade. The Earth Rights, which did this lawsuit against Unocal, which was Chevron bought Unocal a few years ago.
That's Earth Rights International Human Rights Group. Yes,
absolute unprecedented lawsuit using the Alien Claims Torts Act. They came out with a report that disclosed that this is, you know, when the Burmese government has bought, and this is found, a defector came out and reported that they bought all this precision pipe equipment and all these kinds of very specific things that you wouldn't need for regular purposes, and you'd only use them for making rockets and missiles or some sort of advanced piping for like a cooling system. Why would you need this otherwise? They bought this stuff from Europe, in Switzerland and Germany, ironically, and it's almost certain they use the money from Chevron gas project that's kept in these offshore oil accounts. And basically, under the Burmese budget, which does get leaked every year, the way they transfer the way they account the money is using the old exchange rate, which is not, basically it's totally ridiculous. They totally underestimate by 90% the amount of oil revenues or gas revenues coming from these two gas projects Yedigun, and they underestimate it by like 95%. So the money is kept in, the bulk of that money is kept in Singapore and then used for whatever purposes the generals want. And interestingly enough, though, the IAE, a guy who used to work for the IAE and looked at the stuff that Burma had.
That's the International Atomic Commission, right?
Yeah.
The monitoring agency.
Yeah, and he said that they'd still be, you know, decades away from acquiring a weapon at this rate, because really the generals are, they're very incompetent. I mean, they're buying lots of expensive equipment, and they don't really know what they're doing. So it's really sad. They're at the same time they're buying these new planes from China, and they're buying equipment from India, and they're really sort of balancing it out. often I think it's oversimplified as Burma is controlled by China or something, but it's really the generals in charge are sort of, they're balancing it out. They buy some stuff from China, they sell them stuff, they're making deals with India, they have deals with France and deals with Chevron. One of the reasons that France is so unwilling to support the Burma opposition movement at the international forums like the UN is because Total has such a big project there, and Total is so well connected with the French government, including Bernard Kouchner, who's, you know, Mr. So-called Responsibility to Protect, and in fact wrote a report endorsing Total's activities in Burma and said that these health clinics they were building were great, and the project didn't involve forced labor because it would be impossible for children to carry the pipes. That was what Bernard Kouchner wrote in his report before he became foreign minister. And of course, Earth Rights as well documented that massive human rights abuses have happened in the area where this pipeline that travels between Burma to Thailand, that's the Total Chevron corridor, and they've documented massive human rights abuses. In fact, two months ago, Earth Rights came out with a report that said that two villagers have been shot earlier this year by Total, the Total Battalion, which is the nickname for the soldiers who are working for the Total troops there. It really is kind of ironic that, we have... everyone says let's support Burma, but at the same time we have these Western companies that are still doing business there and basically getting away with destroying the environment and giving the generals a great way to arm themselves. 20 years ago when the Burmese regime was, or 22 years ago when they were almost overthrown in 88, the generals really didn't have that much money for equipment and stuff like that. The Burmese army was about a third of what it is size now. And they've used this oil revenue and gas revenue to really increase their strength, and they haven't developed the actual country at all. So the economy is really, it's really suffering because of this sort of natural resource curse, that's something that you see in Equatorial Guinea and Angola and Nigeria, other places where the offshore oil has really actually destroyed the environment and really undermined democracy and not develop the country at all. It's really a bitter curse, and I think that that's what we're going to get with Burma as well. It's just going to get worse as more of these gas projects come online, as the Law Clan are going to get their little pipe from the three things they own with the three spots they own with the Chinese, and that's going to be great for them and their friends and the generals, and none of this money will actually come down back to the Burmese people. So that's, it is really a bitter irony, I think, and unfortunately I think it's just going to get worse in other places as well.
And of course it would be very difficult for the world to claim ignorance on the human rights front, given that one of the most legendary political prisoners well known in this world is Aung San Suu Kyi. She is still, what has she been under house arrest for, about 15 years?
Yeah.
This is the pro-democracy leader, Nobel laureate, the United States, Hillary Clinton, who loves to champion for women, knows she is still being brutalized. The pro-democracy movement is still being brutalized there. They have been documented using rape as a tool of war. We have extensive information about them purposely exposing their opposition to the AIDS virus within these dungeons of prisons. So this is a most significant human rights violator who has, even if it's incompetent, has been demonstrated to be trying to get nuclear weapons. That also comes through the United Nations. We see what they're doing to their people. They're in business with Transocean through the Chinese. They're in business with major oil companies in France and the United States. And nobody seems to care. I'm glad that you do. I want to let people know we've been speaking with Thomas Meng Shui. He writes for the Mazima News Agency in Chiang Mai. That's the north of Thailand, where he's talking to us from now. And we will continue this dialogue with you, Thomas, on this very important story.
Well, thank you very much, Dennis. And I'll just, if anyone wants to check out our website, it's www.mizzima.com, Mizzima, MIZZIMA.com. And we will have updates posted there, and really glad that you did this interview, and thanks to all the people of Flashpoints.
Well, it's our pleasure, and we appreciate working with you. More to come. Thanks, Thomas.
All right. Thank you very much.
That wraps it up for the Best of Flashpoints this week, online at flashpoints.net. Thanks for listening.